if you will, to Matthew 26. We're in that chapter again. It's on page 1545. If you're using one of the Bibles in the pews or on the rows in the back, page 1545. Last week, Pastor Mark led us in an exposition of that part of 26 that talks about Jesus' agony in his prayers in the Garden of Gethsemane. And before that, we looked at the Lord's Supper. Today, we want to look at the way religious people have tended to manipulate Jesus. And that was there from the beginning. It's evidenced by the trial of Jesus before the religious high court of the Jews in Jerusalem at the time of Christ, the Sanhedrin. Next week, we want to reflect a little bit about the way secular people have tended to manipulate Jesus. Religious people don't have the corner on the manipulation of others, and that is clear in the trial of Jesus before the Gentile civil court, the court administered by Rome, the occupying power in Jerusalem, and presided over just by a judge who was Pontius Pilate, the governor of Judea. Religious people, and by that I mean people who believe in God and believe that the world around us should be run by principles revealed by God, have different motives and are shaped by a different worldview than secular people are. And by secular people, I mean people who may or may not believe in God, but who, when it comes to questions about how the world around us should be run, are inclined to leave God out of the picture altogether. These two groups are and have been enormously different in lots of ways, but they have this one thing in common with each other and also with us. They're sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. And therefore, ever since our first parents fell from innocence, they, like us, have what has become a natural bent toward manipulating others, including God. Well, we come to verse 45 of chapter 26. Then Jesus returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour is near, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. With him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged the signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Friend, do what you came for." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Put your sword back in its place," Jesus said to him, "for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way?" At that time, Jesus said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled." One of Matthew's great themes. Then all the disciples deserted him and fled. Let's pray together, shall we? O Lord in heaven, give us ears to hear now. These are amazing things that we read about. We've heard them, many of us, hundreds of times. But give us fresh eyes to see these things, O Lord, and to at least begin to plumb the depths of your mercy and grace and even your power in this. Hear us, we pray now, for our sake and for the sake of Christ who has loved us. Amen. These two trials in Matthew 26 and 27 are about injustice. A theme as important today as it was 2,000 years ago when these events took place. An important theme to many of you who have worked hard at trying to overcome the emotional, the spiritual, sometimes even the physical pain, the deficits that are there in your life from having been treated unjustly. Some of your stories are absolutely agonizing. But here's the good news for you. It's really great news, and it's for everyone everywhere. And it's astoundingly paradoxical. These trials were jokes. But it is by submitting to the injustice in the travesty of an impartial trial. Twice, these trials were travesties, but it is precisely by submitting to the injustice of these trials that Jesus Christ actually secured the end of all injustice. Because he did what Dorothy Sayers once said, only the incarnate God of Abraham can do. He wrenched a real and positive good out of a real evil. Let's look more closely here. First comes the arrest. The arrest following Jesus' agony in the garden from verses 47 through 56. And what I want us to do is to ponder here the brazen injustice of man and the remarkable, astounding, humble restraint of God. What's the first injustice here? Well, it is the behind-the-back betrayal of a friend. Now, some of you know that, don't you, in your own life? Here's Judas. Now, the betrayer had arranged a signal with them, that is, with those that Jesus was being handed over to. Behind Jesus' back, Judas had said, "The one I kiss, that's the man. Arrest him." And so he comes into the garden. He recognizes Jesus. He knows Jesus. It's dark out, but there are torches. They're going at once to Jesus. Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. He might as well have stabbed him. What a remarkable injustice. Matthew here is alluding back to the earlier verses of chapter 26, where in verses 14 through 16, Judas had gone to the authorities and said, "What do you pay me if I hand him over to you?" He had become disillusioned. It's difficult to be sure of the reasons why. But here is the first injustice, not simply committed by Judas, a friend, but an injustice in the hands of the religious authorities, the use of money to manipulate the outcome in a religious and or a political dispute. Remember, Israel's a theocracy at this time. The Sanhedrin has authority not simply over the religious affairs of the state, but over the state itself. Kickbacks, payoffs, hush money, blackmail, extortion, bribes, all of them are ways of using money unjustly to get what you want, and in so many cases to circumvent the law. The payoff to Judas here was actually the second injustice committed by the religious leaders. The first is mentioned in verses 3 through 5 of chapter 26, right at the beginning Go back to that for a moment. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. Well, there is, first of all, this undercover arrest. Undercover arrests are not intrinsically unjust, are they? Depends on who you're arresting. But here they are arresting the one that is called the Prince of Life, and the one who only did good. He's arrested, and they come to him with clubs and swords, and they tie his hands and put him under arrest. That indeed was an injustice. But so was the religious and political judgment that Jesus had to be eliminated because he was a threat to good order and peace in what? In God's household. That's what Israel was. God's church, his chosen people and nation. They determine that Jesus has to be eliminated. So they want to kill him because they judge him to be a threat to good order and peace and fidelity to God. Well, let's come back to the arrests. They come into the garden. Judas betrays him, identifies Jesus. That is indeed the brazen injustice of man, but look at the humble restraint here of God. Jesus replied, "Friend, do what you came for." He actually calls him a friend. Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. But Jesus chastises him, "Put your sword back in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think that I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Jesus restrains the power by which, with one word, all of these people could have simply dropped over dead or immobilized by a divine taser effect, as it were. He has all power in heaven on earth, and he simply says to his betrayer, "Do what you have to do," and he offers his hands to be tied. The humble restraint of God. Do you know how many soldiers are in a Roman legion? 6,000. Do you know how many angels 12 legions of angels is? That's 72,000 angels who are bodiless spirits, who have control of all kinds of supernatural things, and they are at his disposal. Do you remember the Gary Larson cartoon where there's this guy, Norman, and he's playing God in the quiz game, and God has 1,065 points, and Norman doesn't even have one point on the board? This is God. Jesus restrains himself, and he chooses not to act, and he says simply, "If I were to do that, the whole plan would not come about. It has to be this way, because God has purposed it." What amazing restraint. How good are you at restraining yourself in the face of injustice? Big ones, even little ones. Most of us, I think, can time ourselves pretty well. We come up to an intersection, we can judge pretty quickly when it's our right to go. Who got there first? And if I'm a half a second before the next car and that car goes first, I feel indignation because a small infraction of justice has been committed against me. Well, Jesus restrains himself, doesn't he? But he also challenges his captors. Look at verse 55. It must happen this way, Jesus says. But then he turns to the crowd and he says, am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled. Surely Jesus is castigating them for their profound misunderstanding of who he is, of what his aims are. And castigating them too, I think, for manipulating their opposition to him. Their opposition to him was primarily religious. They didn't like his message. They didn't like his authority. They didn't like his power and his popularity. In chapter 27, we'll find these words. Pilate knew it was out of envy that they handed him over to them. That's what really was driving things. But what did they do? They're going to claim it's in the interest of the well-being of the state, the commonwealth. But they despise Jesus. Well, in verse 57, we move from the arrest to the interrogation or the preliminary judgment. It's an interesting exercise to put all these gospels side by side, and they each report different aspects of things, but there seems to have been, this is early in the morning, very early in the morning, but there seems to have been a preliminary judgment. Beginning at verse 57, those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. They weren't just looking for made-up lies. They were looking for evidence to put him to death, and that by definition would be false evidence because of who Jesus is. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. And the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent. What restraint? The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. It's literally you said. But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? He is worthy of death, they answered. And they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you? Trials are too important to be left to juries. That line comes from out of the mouth of a man by the name of Rankin Fitch, a despicable jury consultant played by Gene Hackman, who rigs juries for big money in the 2004 film Runaway Jury. There are many modern films about the miscarriage of justice, in spite of judicial systems everywhere set up to prevent it. The Sanhedrin, as I said, had the responsibility to govern all the internal affairs, not of the whole of Israel. Their authority had actually been narrowed down by Rome. They had no authority in Galilee, but they did have authority in Judea. The Sanhedrin was composed of three groups of men, the leading clergy, also called the chief priests, the elders, those were the lay leaders of the people, and the scribes, or the teachers of the law. There were 70 members of the Sanhedrin. All they needed to do business, less severe quorum than we have here, was one third. In the movie Runaway Jury, Rankin Fitch says at one point to his team of manipulators and dirty tricksters in court, "Somebody always loses, just not me." Well, the high priest Caiaphas might have said something like that to his cronies on this night, because it's clear that he intends for Jesus to go down one way or the other. They had already decided the verdict before the trial began. So the formal proceedings here are a complete sham. And yet the trial has to have the appearance of legality. Probably, first of all, for the sake of the Jewish public, but also for the sake of the Roman governor. They violated all sorts of their own legal rules as well. In a capital case, you were not allowed to have a trial at night. When a person's life is at stake, it's absolutely crucial that things are done decently and in order. Well, they set that aside. They also remembered from the law that they needed two witnesses to convict someone where the death penalty is involved. Now, it doesn't really matter to them if the evidence is credible. It doesn't matter if the witnesses are credible. Everything is for show. Everything is here just to be manipulated. But even though they were quite happy to accept even perjured testimony, Matthew tells us. Verse 60 tells us that they were having trouble making any charges stick. Look at what Matthew says. "But they did not find any witnesses, though many false witnesses came forward." They couldn't make a charge stick. They want to find a crime where upon conviction there would be the death penalty. They knew the Old Testament law. Such a crime is identified in the 24th chapter of Leviticus, where we read, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Anyone who blasphemes the name of the Lord must be put to death. The entire assembly must stone him.'" Well, finally, Caiaphas gets a break. Finally, two witnesses came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer?" He wants Jesus to answer. He wants a self-incriminating answer. But Jesus is silent. So then the high priest puts him under oath. "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus answered, "You've said it," essentially. It is clearly taken by Caiaphas to be a positive, affirmative answer on Jesus' part. And Caiaphas' response, you can just imagine him inside saying, "There it is. We got it. Cinched. Blasphemy." He tears his robes in a symbolic act of outrage that the name of God should be blasphemed. And then he asks them for their judgment, and they all cry out with one accord, "He's guilty, he's worthy of death." Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you?" One of the other Gospels tells us that that's because he had blindfold on. What a travesty of justice on the part of sinful people, abusing, ridiculing, beating up the one man who loved perfectly. What humble restraint on the part of Jesus, the all-powerful Son of God. He takes it. Not because he's weak and doesn't know how to stand up for himself, but he knows that this is the way, and it is the only way to end all injustice. Why is it that religious people in particular so often have manipulated Jesus? Well, it's because they have their own agendas. And hiding behind God, believe it or not, is a very effective way to advance your own agenda. But they hated Jesus because Jesus exposed all attempts to manipulate God. Here is how one writer reflects on this trial. He says, the Sanhedrin condemned Jesus for claiming that he was able to destroy the temple and rebuild it. Now, it's interesting because we don't know if this witness, these two witnesses who have said that Jesus said, I will destroy the temple and rebuild it, we don't know if they're citing what Jesus actually said on one occasion or if they're simply distorting what we learn in John 2, where on one occasion Jesus said, if this temple is destroyed, I can rebuild it in 3 days. But he's right in saying that to the Sanhedrin, that was equivalent to claiming God's power, and it had to be blasphemy. Surely Jesus didn't have that kind of power, never mind that he had spent several years very publicly giving sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, and raising the dead. But there's a deeper trial going on. The God of Israel comes to Israel, and Israel puts him on trial. They condemn God incarnate on the basis of true testimony, his claim to be able to destroy and rebuild the temple. Jesus really claims such power, and he really has it. But the Sanhedrin don't want such a God who commits the blasphemy of destroying and rebuilding temples. They want a God of guarantees. Sometimes that's what you and I want. Whose entire reason for being is to ensure that their temple will stand and keep standing, no matter what. Like all pagans, they want a God who ensures the persistence of the past, not a God who breaks down to make a new future. For them, a God who destroys and raises up is a blasphemous God. That's what Sanhedrins of every age long for, a God who sanctions their tradition, a God who kicks over their little monuments they will always send to the cross. Such is the heart of human beings, fallen as we are. Friends, what have you been doing with those injustices committed against you? By an employer, perhaps, an employee, by a parent, a child, a spouse? What have you been doing with them? Brooding over them obsessively? Projecting anger onto others because of it? Miring yourself down in self-pity? Or are you simply alone with them because you've never told anyone about them? Are you embittered against God on account of them? Well, take heart. Jesus knows from his own experience the crushing hurt, the humiliation of being treated unjustly. He can sympathize with you. C.S. Lewis said it wonderfully when he said, in the incarnation, God the Son takes the body and human soul of Jesus, and through that, the whole environment of nature, all the creaturely predicament, into his own being. So that the words, he came down from heaven, can almost be transposed into heaven drew earth up into it, and locality, limitation, sleep, sweat, footsore weariness, frustration, pain, doubt, and death. And we could add others, couldn't we? Humiliation, abuse, oppression, being cheated, being slandered, being manipulated by others. All these things are known by God from within. That is, God Himself knows it from His experience. If we stopped there, that would indeed be good news. But there is something more that we can have. And we can have it just for the asking. Something more than this comforting, powerful sympathy of Jesus Christ with us and with all who suffer unjustly. There is something more. In the movie Runaway Jury, there is a scene where Rankin Fitch warns his crew of manipulators, and it proves to be a prophetic moment in the film. He says, 30 years in the trenches has taught me this. There's always a loose end. So there is in the movie. So there was at the palace of the high priest. This was God in human flesh they were putting on trial. Friends, if there ever was a loose end that you couldn't manipulate, it was Jesus Christ, the everlasting Son of God. Oh my gosh, they have no idea who they have messed with. Go back to verse 64. As soon as Jesus says, and in effect, yes, you have spoken, that is who I am, he says, but I say to all of you, and perhaps we should translate, indeed, this is what it means that I am the Son of God. I say to all of you, in the future, it's literally from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. What does he mean? The Son of Man was Jesus' self-designation. It goes back to the 7th chapter of Daniel. Jesus applied it to himself. But there we have a window onto the vision that Daniel was given. It's the great conflict between God and those who have opposed him. And he sees a horn, represents evil, evil powers. The horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I, Daniel, looked, he sees this. Thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated. The books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. And then he sees this. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. That's what Jesus means. From now on, this is who I am. Yes, I willingly now submit myself. I have closed my mouth. I have not exercised my power. But I am more than a sympathizer with those who are oppressed and treated unjustly. I am the one who out of that is able to secure the end of everything that is evil, everything that is oppressive and unjust. He is not simply Christ, your sympathizer. He is Christ, your redeemer, friends. No jury can make true amends by injustices committed, by awarding monetary damages. No counselor can fully heal the scars of humiliation and contempt inflicted on our souls by things that are unjust. No amount of time can neutralize the righteous anger in us that every act of injustice provokes. Only Christ, in his willingness to be destroyed by injustice, can heal yours. Only Christ, as the coming judge, has the power to make every perpetrator of injustice accountable for their actions. In a most remarkable, paradoxical way, in this silence, in the binding of his wrists, in submitting himself to be spit at, to be punched and slapped, the end of all humiliation is rendered possible. The Word became flesh. He assumed everything that flesh is heir to. All our weaknesses, all our sorrows, all our sickness and shatteredness, all our God-forsakenness, he took to himself. But not merely to identify or sympathize. He took it all to himself to overcome. He goes to the cross as flesh and rises spirit. He assumed flesh in order to fill it with the power of the Spirit. But, and this is absolutely crucial, we still live in the flesh. We are still broken, sorrowful, weak, shattered. Jesus died and rose, not so we could instantly slough off fleshliness, but so that our fleshliness could be transformed from within by the Spirit, so that weakness could be the form of power, brokenness the form of wholeness, and forsakenness the form of intimacy. That's the power of the cross that we just sung about, and the empty tomb, the end of all injustice, the ability now to see it transformed, even by Christ who loves us, who is at the right hand of power, who's coming again to judge everything.